I'm Robert Sickles, and I'm here with Kinda Kiefel, and this is the cold open number 50.
Yes.
The Wonderful World of Henry Sugar edition. And today we'll be looking at the four short films recently released on Netflix by Wes Anderson that are adaptations of short stories from the short story collection of the same name by Roald Dahl. For our 50th edition here, I'd just like to point out a couple things. This will be, as concerns our regular full-length pods, Wes Anderson's third time being featured. He previously done pods on Asteroid City and The French Dispatch, making him the most featured artist for the regular cold opens. Second is P.T. Anderson, where we did pods on The Phantom Thread and Licorice Pizza. But if you include the cold open minis, of which we did 40 during the pandemic, the artist that has actually been featured the most on the cold open is Zack Snyder.
Yes. Oh, wow.
Yeah. So we did six mini pods on the Justice League. We first did the original cut, then we did the different parts of the Snyder cut. And then we also did one on Army of the Dead, which we both really liked, nice. The zombie movie. And technically, he was not the sole subject of the pod, but we did a pod on worst franchises and Transformers made an appearance. So there's been a lot of Zack Snyder, which is really interesting.
It's quite an upset. Right? That's kind of amazing. I did not expect that.
I think we're obviously like an auteurist minded podcast. And you know, the question of is Zack Snyder an auteur or not? I think the answer is clear. He is. He definitely
is. Yes.
In there. Okay. So we'll start with the Wonderful World of Henry Sugar, because this was the first one that was released on Netflix. They were released over four successive days. And Kinda, why don't you start off with telling us your initial thoughts on it, and we'll go from there.
I thought it was one of the most visually captivating ways to tell a story, as Wes Anderson is already, as we all know, excellent at. Something different happened here, and I was really chewing on this through all of the shorts, but Henry Sugar in particular being the first and being the longest, and to me, the most visually delicious, I would say. Something really hypnotic happened that is like reading, and we will delve, I'm sure, into what all makes the sort of hypnosis happen for these pieces. But what I found so fascinating is that it felt like, more so than I think I've comprehended with a writing into film, is that it still had some sort of effect of reading and sort of picturing what you see in your mind, and the layers of that, the corridors of how you move into a book and get immersed into it. Something felt different about this as far as Wes Anderson's style applied here that was absolutely gorgeous to me and truly delicious. So also Ben Kingsley is a hypnotic figure and just so undeniably great that, you know, you're right in it. But I just thought it was so incredibly creative and really felt like a tribute to Roald Dahl, and really felt like it felt like reading or being read to. And I just thought that was a successful surprise. How about you? What was your initial takes?
I quite liked it. You know, I had read that he'd been trying to adapt this for years and that he couldn't, and he said he cracked it once he had the characters speak as though they were reading the book.
Yes.
So we get the he said, she said, and then he went kind of thing where they look directly into the camera,
yes,
repeatedly and say that. And it was, on first viewing, it was odd, right?
Yes.
You're not used to
very
that.
Very odd, yeah.
I got used to it very quickly, and I've since watched it a couple more times, and including last night in preparation for this, and I don't even notice it. Like, yes. It's kind of amazing how it just becomes a part of the process. And it's such an interesting stylistic technique. But if anybody's going to do something like literarily stylistic, obviously it's going to be Wes Anderson. I wanted to ask you about your take on the structure of it. Wes Anderson has been accused, and perhaps not unjustly, of repeating himself, of doing the same thing kind of over and over again. And I would argue that's true, but he does the same thing and then some.
Yes.
In this one. So when I think of Anderson, I think of him as our most literary director, in the sense that there's always a framing storytelling device, whatever that is. And it's become even more so over the time. So when we think of like Fantastic Mr. Fox, it literally starts another doll adaptation. It starts with the book cover.
Yes.
Royal Tenenbaums is ostensibly a telling of the book, Royal Tenenbaums. Grand Budapest Hotel is a writer writing about a writer who's writing about his experience. It's like that Russian doll kind of experience. And then like French Dispatch is very much, you know, it's the stories inside the magazine. And then Asteroid City kind of took it even more deeply because it's a play. Like, we're seeing like a take on a play, which is our framing device. And in this one, it's Dahl himself writing in Gypsy House, who serves as kind of our recurring narrator, but the way it seamlessly transitions to the characters reading their own parts, I thought was pretty cool. And like, it's as close as a movie can be to a book, like, yes, the way that it feels. But it also feels kind of in some of the same way that Asteroid City did, but more so, both like theater, like, mm-hmm, far and away his most theatrical,
yes,
production.
It's a play.
Yeah, because there's those movable mats in the same way you would have that set design for a high-end theater play. There's those mats that are moved and placed, and doors open that reveal new scenes. And the scene where we first see the person who teaches Imdad Khan how to do what it is that he does, where it's like layers and layers and layers and layers.
That's my favorite
part. So you get that. And it also reminded me a lot of Méliès, like that early, early cinema where he did so much with mats and the movement of mats and different levels and layers.
Yeah.
So it was visually really amazing in a way when normally we talk about the visual acuity of a film, we're talking about the cinematography.
Yeah.
And this was pretty straightforward. There were a few, not a lot, but there's a few of those Andersonian tracks. But for the most part, it's pretty static, which,
yep,
you know, obviously he does that a lot as well, the centered static shots. But within the static frame, there's so much motion and movement of the various mats in a way that I'd never seen before. It was really cool.
I agree. No, I couldn't agree more. It was so creative in that, you're right, that theater transition, and having just seen a play on Saturday, as you know, the way that theater works magically, that I feel like Anderson completely captured here, is that immediate suspension of disbelief, even though it is utterly and admittedly artifice upon artifice upon artifice, the flats that you're talking about, the layers of two-dimensional that are oddly, weirdly, so easy to accept when the story gets going, and then to play with that as far as depth is concerned, like you're speaking to that visit to the jungle and the sort of the way in and the series of layers that we get to the yogi's hut with is so extra magical because it's so admittedly fake, if that makes sense. It's the lie that gets us to the ultimate truth, that is really, especially in the Henry Sugar piece, so touching. I feel like there was multiple points that were so true feeling, and even though that the artifice is actually played for laughs in certain parts with the stage hands changing his mustache and the mustache not ticking and pieces like that that are like the little comedy bits of the overall narrative are so interesting in the way that not only does Wes Anderson admit that this is storytelling, but he wants to like really drive it home. Like you're saying, it's the most version of that where, which is so funny because I remember, doing theater in college. And there was this moment when I thought of this as I was watching all these, where this electrician just walked through this really dramatic scene between these two people. He just walked in the background with a big cord wrapped around his shoulder, and it was an accident. And it was the funniest thing that ever happened in that theater because it was so out of place. And that the beauty of these stagehand helpers that become characters in the storytelling. I just was really excited about that device and what Wes Anderson was driving home. It was pretty smart. Yeah.
And those characters, the characters, if you will, the stagehand, they become immediately acceptable as well,
yes,
right? It's
exactly.
Weird when you see them the first time.
That's right.
And then you just don't even notice them in
no.
Much the same way that a play works. And
exactly.
Going back to that idea of the narrative, it's a book within a short story, right?
Yes.
Because this doll kind of writing
right.
It.
Yes.
Based on a story that was told to him. And then Cumberbatch finds that book. And then Cumberbatch reads the book, or at least it's like he's reading the book, but then immediately the narrative switches to Z.Z. Chatterjee.
Yes.
Right? Who,
yes.
Who is the author of that book. So that Russian doll quality that he does over and over again in his films is maybe the most extreme
yes,
that it's ever
it
been.
Is. It is, and probably the most well-served in a weird way. I feel like this is both new feeling and the most Wes Anderson anything has ever been. It's like what he's been getting to or training for in a weird way. Was there any point where you were taken out of the narrative by the devices that he was employing? I'm just curious, because I was thinking about this the whole time. It was like, which parts immerse us the most, and does anything make it hard to listen to the story in your mind?
That's a great question, Kinda. And the answer for me is no. But again, I wonder who this is for. And the reason I say that is when you get to what I would call advanced Anderson, right, at this point
yep.
in his career, there is, if you are a fan of his work and you've watched his work, there is a subtle learning curve that comes from watching the earlier works. So that by the time you get to this one, it's not a surprise. And in fact, it's a delight because
yes.
you're seeing him do this thing that he does, but more so. Whereas what if you've never watched a Wes Anderson
yes.
film and you're on Netflix, and these came and went, to be fair. They did not capture the zeitgeist. They weren't something that was talked about in the same way a lot of other things that come on Netflix. Like right now, everybody's talking about The Killer.
Right.
Fincher's The Killer, right? And, you know, things don't capture the imagination often on streaming as long as they might if they were theatrically distributed. But this was a blip, and
yeah.
it didn't seem to create conversation outside of those of us who already were interested
yeah.
in that. So that, I guess my response is I had no issue with it, but I wonder how the heck people who don't know or like Anderson, if they could even watch this. You can
right.
imagine people turning it off pretty quickly.
Yes. No, unfairly so. It was so not promoted, and you're right. I was thinking the exact same thing, having finished the other shorts this weekend. Like, if you don't know, I guess what we could call also the Anderson cadence or voice, because this is more like reading through out loud, but I would also say that there is a delivery that's a little bit deadpan, a little bit quippy, clever, that is not quite how people talk, but is a beautiful writing style and directing and delivery style that I feel like Anderson, that's another piece of his signature, which I feel like is most apparent in the recent Asteroid City, where it is a little bit unemotional sometimes and a little bit like reading out loud, like you're doing a first read in some ways, but beautifully delivered at the same time. And I was trying to like picture myself being uninitiated as far as the Anderson oeuvre goes. And I still myself feel like I think and hope. Some people understand that the intention is this straight across, really, really loyal tribute to a piece of literature. But I don't know either if someone would accept it the same way we do as long-term supporters of the Anderson Method. But I do hope there are sort of accidental discoveries in this sense, because I do feel like these were so interesting that they should have gotten more promotion, more attention, more something. Like, it does feel like a blip. It does feel like they were just kind of quietly dumped onto Netflix, and that felt unfair once I saw them. It just was really too bad, because it could have been a huge opportunity.
So I wonder, had this been released as an anthology film in the same way that the French Dispatch was, if it would have had theatrical success. And I don't think it would have. It didn't have the star power that the French Dispatch had, even though it wasn't hugely successful financially. There's something about a theatrical release that generates greater conversation,
yes,
than a Netflix release. I wonder, and this, I'd love to know your thoughts on this. I'm struggling with whether I like this because I like Wes Anderson and I was enamored of the stylistic conceit, which gave me pleasure to watch, mm-hmm, or more so than I was by the emotional impact. And as I've seen this three times, I think it's weaker, mm-hmm, significantly,
okay,
compared to a lot of his things. That way, there's that moment in this film where he realizes, you know, he is doing what he's doing for greed. And the narrator says he was ashamed.
Mm-hmm.
It was an awful feeling. And it's kind of cool, but it's not like Chaz in Royal Tenenbaum saying, "It's been a hard year, Dad." Or like these moments that his films build to that have this great emotional impact. I did not have that in this film at all. And I liked, like, the moral of the story is don't be greedy, right?
Yes.
Do something for others.
Yes.
Pretty straightforward.
Yes.
But it didn't, I wasn't, the characters seem like devices rather than real people. I wasn't invested in them in the same way that I often am in Anderson's better films.
Fair enough. No, I hear that. They were devices. I do feel like there were little pieces that cut through the name of Ben Kingsley's character that is the man that can see.
Imdad Khan.
Thank you. Thank you. When he talks about the person he loved the most and picturing that, and the difference between that for him being his brother who he lost early, and for Henry Sugar being himself at first as he masters the cult. But something was, the little tiny pieces of like what I felt like were kind of heart chakra, little cut throughs, was when Ben Kingsley delivered that little piece of information, but also in the end when Dev Patel says he was a good man. Like, that was weirdly touching to me because he wasn't a good man at first, or he doesn't seem like he's being framed as such by Roald Dahl or the story until that policeman kind of cuts through his consciousness and says, why would you do that? Like, give it to a hospital or an orphanage. They don't even have enough presents at Christmas. Something about those little tiny slivers, because they are devices except for these placed things, which I do think Anderson is quite good at sometimes, those surprising little sparks of emotion in an otherwise sort of deadpan delivery or scene, like that he was a good man being said by someone else, like, kind of got me. It was really beautiful to me. And this wasn't, as far as the short stories go, I know we'll move on to dissect those as well, but I felt like there were little pieces of emotion spent one way, place or the other, but I actually think Henry Sugar had the least amount of those in a way. So, but I hear what you're saying. And
it seemed like for me, there wasn't, we do get some understanding of the character of both Imdad Khan and Henry Sugar, but we don't see them interact. Like,
right,
we don't see characters much interact with other characters, and our three main characters hardly, you know, rarely interact with each other at all.
Yes.
A little bit, I guess. I guess the doctor, Chatterjee, does have interaction with Imdad, but it seems pretty super, like it allows him to understand what's going on, but it's not like in-depth connective conversation that we often see. And like sometimes even in the Wes Anderson films, it's the inability to connect, right?
That's right.
But it still gives us insight into character, but there is nothing like the kids in Moonrise Kingdom or the relationship between our three mains in Rushmore or anything like that. We just don't, for me, we don't have that. So it didn't necessarily make me like it any less. I just really enjoyed it, but I think I kind of enjoyed it as an exercise in Andersonian technique more. It didn't move me
enough,
a way that his best films often deeply do. So with that in mind, let's kind of move on to the other three. I want to talk about The Rat Catcher first.
Okay, sounds great.
And I really dislike this.
Okay.
In lots of ways. But the main way I liked it is I just wasn't, it's personal probably more than substantive, I just wasn't interested in the story. And I don't have any idea what I was supposed to take from it. Tell me what you thought.
No, it was the most baffling of the three shorter of the shorts. I did love the way that Ralph Fiennes was, right? Yeah, that's right. Ralph Fiennes, was chewing it up real good as well, ironically, but he seemed to be enjoying himself so hard. But I do feel like it was the sort of oddly least compelling, even though it was the most cartoonish in a way and the most wild and strange. But I felt an emptiness at the end. I guess I was expecting something different. And I actually watched it again this morning just to see if I could like rev up some emotion. But there was something sort of lacking in the center of it, even though it was sort of the most theatrical too, as far as the way it was filmed, the lighting, the weirdness of his rat-like qualities, and the pantomiming of violence or the still shots of violence, which I actually feel like those are done throughout all of these, but it was strangest in The Rat Catcher, as in like he's holding an animal that's not there, but then we get this bizarre taxidermied and then subsequently stop motion animated large rat that he fights in the end and bites. But I, even with that and its oddness, I felt a lack of something. What did you think about the sort of various treatments of the creatures themselves? Like, what was your takeaway from that?
It was surprising to me. Like, I don't care for rats, so that could be part of the deal. I think they're gross.
And they're upsetting.
I think the short made that, like, emphasized their grossness in a way that it just didn't all of a sudden make them more appealing. To me, I loved once we saw the rat that was so reminiscent of Willem Dafoe's rat in Fantastic Mr. Fox. Exactly. I loved that, like, it's the same doll universe that, of course, the rat would look the same way. Like, I did
that was great.
And I did like, there's a taxonomic thing that goes on here that is also a callback to kind of Fantastic Mr. Fox. And there's this idea, I think, pretty clearly that he's a rat.
Yes.
Right? That
totally.
He's a rat. His fingernails were disgusting.
Yes, that was so just gross.
But am I supposed to, like, the characters at the end clearly dislike him, but I just don't understand the point of this story. And I have not read the source material, so I don't know if there's something missing, a subtextual thing that I didn't understand, but I was just kind of repulsed from start to finish. And I'm not sure what the point was other than repulsion. It really kind of left me wanting. And I wondered about the choice that you're talking about, the pantomiming of various things. It was an intriguing choice to me because there's so much attention paid to detail in other ways. Why do you have to pantomime?
Right. Yes.
Like, I'm not quite
very
sure.
Weird. Right. And I kind of loved it too. There was like a puppetry, invisible puppetry to it that was like a play too. But I agree. It almost felt like an unfinished story, whereas like the success in my mind of the sort of gut punch, the last 30 seconds of Poison that we'll talk about in a minute, the effect of what I feel like a great short story does as far as that like punchline or whatever you want to call it, where I do feel like the quick build towards a strange and often surprising payoff, like there wasn't that, right? This was utterly I guess character-based, but why? You're right, besides repulsion, where does it get us in the end? Because we are in the same place we started, which I also feel like in, you know, as English majors and like in having taken writing classes, both of us, I'm sure like we were all told that there is something supposed to change at the end with even with a short story or something supposed to be revealed. I don't know really what we didn't know already. It didn't seem even sort of subvertingly political or anything. It wasn't a day in the life. It wasn't a lot of things. So I was left both wanting and baffled as far as the intention of our takeaway with that, except as an experiment, like you said, as something that I guess rounds out what he was attracted to as far as these little stories. But to me, it felt like half a story, perhaps. And I don't know that the side characters were, or the other characters in the story were, really effective in almost any way. As far as, I mean, I love both those actors, but they didn't carry much or counter enough to make there even be a central conflict that we then move toward or against, right? So
it's almost as though they existed so that Ralph Fiennes' character wasn't monologuing.
Yes.
Right? So
yes.
There was somebody that he was talking to, but it's essentially like him monologuing for the entire...
Yes.
The entire time.
Yeah, almost an audition or something.
Yeah.
Right? Like,
And he clearly was having fun.
The like best time.
Yeah.
That was the best part, is his palpable enjoyment of that weird character and how different that I feel like that character is than almost anything I've ever seen him play. He's always so dignified and refined and very often I feel like a likable, he was pretty repulsive and he seemed to enjoy that. So maybe it's just a present for him.
So would you ever go back to it?
I don't know that I would, unless I was asking someone like you, like, what am I missing here a little bit?
I don't
think I would.
I don't think I would either. I've seen it 3 times, which I feel like was too many. I teach that class, The Magnificent Andersons, where we watch the films of P.T. and Wes, and we can't watch them all. You have to cut things, and like the longer I teach the class, kind of the more you have to cut, unfortunately.
Sure.
But this is something I would surely cut. I actually might not show any of these shorts
In
that
class.
I might just stick with theatrical. Well, if you think about it, like Paul Thomas Anderson's done a ton of music videos and things like that, and I don't usually show those, although I've shown some of the stuff that he did for Radiohead, and he did something for Tom York a few years ago that was incredible.
That's right.
Yeah, this even if I was going to show the shorts, I would probably not show
this one. Fair enough. Sorry, can I just say it's interesting that you had mentioned music video, because I was thinking about like video essays and this as an exercise in like a spoken music video almost, and adding essence without like dictating narrative as far as the visual choices. So I'm glad you said music video, because I feel like that kind of factored into this literary storytelling that we're discussing now. So
I think that's fair. Well, let's move on to Poison.
Okay.
And it's got that Ricky Tikki Tavi feel with
the
crate, right? The snake.
Very Ricky Tikki Tavi. Yes.
You talked about the gut punch at the end, so why don't we just jump right into this? The basic setup is Harry, the Benedict Cumberbatch character, has a crate, a snake, a deadly poisonous snake that has fallen asleep on his stomach, and Dev Patel's character comes to find him, and they call a doctor, who's Dr. Ganderby, played by Ben Kingsley.
Yes, exactly. And so much of it is about tension and building that tension in it, which I do feel like it does quite effectively in just the down facing shot of us just really seeing the refrain of Cumberbatch's stressed, sweating face and the twitching that is mentioned as sort of a chorus almost as the build increases and becomes more and more tense with each whisper. I feel like there's something inherently great, I feel like always, about people trying to stay quiet and still that is so stressful. And it really, it was beautiful to watch that because I actually don't know that I've seen a lot of Wes Anderson, like stress in that sense in sound and in movement. I don't know that I've seen tons of that exact device used by him in his work. And so there was something that felt oddly new, even though it was very Wes Anderson aesthetically. There was something about the tense build that felt unique and felt most like a short story, most like something that is building toward a single sentence payoff. And so as we see the doctor comes, he gives him the serum, the antidote, and then soaks the mattress, right, in chloroform. Is that what they land on? Or okay. And they're trying to drug the snake, right? And the pan down his body was so extra stressful. I don't know. What did you think about the actual visual devices as far as this piece goes as in comparison to the other ones?
I thought it was fine. The three of these, the first, The Wonderful World of Henry Sugar, The Rat Catcher, and Poison, were all shot by Robert Yeoman, who mm-hmm. shot all of his films with the exception of Fantastic Mr. Fox and Isle of Dogs, the stop motion ones. But it's got that visual consistency that we see throughout his films that comes from having made so many films with that collaborator. But it also, I was pretty frustrated by this film. It seemed like a trick.
Yeah.
Just starting
it is a trick.
With the
yeah.
snake on yeah. the stomach. Yes. And again, like, what's the point? Why
right.
do we have to have, I don't understand. I have my suspicions and I actually
yes.
want to talk about them.
Please.
But
yeah.
it was, I did not care about this movie at all.
Okay.
I didn't know this character with a snake on them, and
right.
As a humanist, I don't want to see anybody die from snake bite. But the stakes are much higher
yes.
if the character.
If we care,
if
exactly.
you care about the character.
Yes.
So it wasn't until his explosion at the end that this film caught my attention.
Exactly, which does feel like some short stories that I eventually liked, as far as that genre goes, like something was so shocking about that final, like, awful stab of racism that, and there's something about the ingratitude towards a doctor that saves your life, and worse yet, the sort of accepted reaction of the doctor, because obviously he has to face this all the time. That sadly, it wasn't a surprise to him. And that was really heartbreaking to me, and I thought it was really effective. It actually really, it really was a gut punch to me, and really, it's what good short stories do. And so I felt like this was among a very literary batch. This was the most literary in that sense, even though I wouldn't say it was my favorite. I didn't like enjoy every bit of it, but I did feel like that payoff and the idea of the metaphor of a snake lying in wait to be venomous between human beings is pretty brilliant as a device. But yeah, what's your theory on
that? So I have a question about
yes,
this for
please.
You. I'm kind of fascinated by it. Like, is there such a thing as auteur washing? And what I mean by that is, you know, Saudi Arabia has been accused of sports washing, right?
Yes.
Investing so much money in golf and the World Cup, et cetera, to like, to draw attention away from its human rights record.
Yes.
And In recent, you know, it's pretty clear that, Roald Dahl was an admitted anti-Semite who said some pretty horrible things. And yet, the dialogue, what there was of it around the, release of these films, had nothing to do with Dahl and his personal life. It had to do with the Andersonian touch.
Right.
And to his credit, Anderson, by including this and having it be such an explosion of vile racism at the end,
yes,
he doesn't shy away from it. But I think it, a lot of viewers would see that as an example of racism by the character, whereas it's hard not to draw a connection between,
yes,
character and author,
yes,
when the author is Dahl.
Right,
and
exactly.
So I credit Anderson for not shying away from that. It was pretty intriguing,
yes,
that he would do that. But again, I'm not necessarily sure what we're supposed to take from
right.
it. I really like your analysis or your interpretation of this is like the poison between people,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And lying in wait unexpectedly, that as well. That explosion was so hurt. Like, this person just helped you.
Yes.
And probably at least possibly saved your life.
Yes.
And to treat another human being like that.
Bit him.
Right?
He bit him at the end.
He's
yes.
the snake.
He's the snake. And the idea, well, is it possible that this was a moment of revelation, or is it the pot calling the kettle black? Because I thought about that a lot with Roald Dahl being the author of this, and it seeming that he was critiquing racism in one way, but is known as an anti-Semite in another. Like, what does that mean? Was this a lesson that he was trying to teach himself, or is this his, like, ignorance coming through? Because I wrestled with that. So I was like, this is a great point that he is illustrating, but also he is who he was, and that, or is this Anderson like bringing that into focus so that we can critique the author in a weird way? I don't know. I kind of wrestled with that piece of it. So I was like, well, rich and weird coming from Dahl's voice.
Well, Netflix paid an insane amount of money for the rights to the entirety,
okay,
basically, of the Dahl catalog, except maybe I think the Wonka story, which is
okay.
owned elsewhere. And then there's been backlash because of his racism, which is complicated. I don't know that because someone was racist, you shouldn't adapt their art. I just, it gets into a whole question about cancel culture, etc.
Yeah.
But the having Anderson take this on as the first adapter of Dahl was created kind of an interesting elision,
yeah,
of the ugly backdrop of,
yes,
of Dahl's racism,
yeah,
in a way that I found really interesting, which is why I asked that question about auteur washing.
Right.
Is there such,
yes,
a thing as
totally.
That?
Yes. Oh, I appreciate that question. Yeah. It's such a wrestling match every time. And I did struggle. I will say throughout, like, it is hard for me sometimes to separate the artist from the work or the source material from the work. But I do think it's a worthy thing to explore and unpack. And if there's something to be gained from new eyes or, you know, translation through a less problematic person, that's interesting. That's worthy of exploration, I feel like. So I'm grateful to Anderson for being willing to do this in that sense, where he it feels like he's making it something else while still paying a very interesting tribute. So yeah,
he's almost like a buffer.
Yes,
though,
he
right?
is a buffer. Yes,
you,
he is.
It's hard to separate Woody Allen from Manhattan,
big
in
time.
Particular,
it,
as well as some,
yes,
other films.
Yes.
It's hard to separate Polanski from Chinatown, which doesn't lessen the greatness of,
right,
Chinatown, but it's,
no,
difficult. But the separation of Dahl with Poison,
yes,
is Anderson, right?
Yes,
he's the
is.
Buffer. He's
beautiful.
He's the adapter.
He's
that.
The antidote, maybe? Or no,
maybe
at least,
yeah,
just the chloroform and the mattress.
And there's, you know, there have been no I wouldn't call Wes Anderson a racist, but there are certainly issues with some of his films.
Yes.
Darjeeling Limited comes to mind.
Yes,
as
for sure.
Isle of Dogs.
True.
With the white savior sort of thing.
Yeah.
But I don't think, like, he's honestly trying to grapple with these issues in a way that I think separates him from those other artists. But he is a staunch defender of Dahl, but not certainly Dahl's racism, but Dahl's narrative skills and storytelling. So he tries to...
It's creative production.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
he tries to limit his admiration of Dahl to what's on the page. But in this instance, what's on the page is affected by our understanding of Dahl the human being.
Exactly. Exactly right. No, I think... To speak to your point of sort of what Wes Anderson has been critiqued about, there was something interesting about knowing that this is more purely translating source material, even though it's in his style and his adaptation. There was something interesting and sort of more forgivable I would offer in, like, clearly these are all stories about only men and the animals. A lot of times I was just thinking about these thematic ties and through lines and the world of boys and men and sort of grappling with what I also felt like, well, more overtly in Poison, but sort of throughout as this like expectation of masculinity, a sort of like military subtext in, right, because he was in the Royal Air Force, I believe. That was Roald Dahl's part of his life. But there was something interesting to me about just focusing on the world of men and this sort of, grappling with what it means to be a bully, what it means to be a good man, what it means to protect animals versus kill them in the case of the story we're about to discuss. And I actually, that was oddly like easier to me to like not critique the absence of women in this case, because I did feel like this was all focused on a certain set of pieces. But what was your take on the sort of Anderson style as we see this sort of like limited cast and obviously focused view of these short stories?
Well, I think this is a good place to transition to the Swan.
Great.
I think.
Yeah.
And what I would, kind of along those lines, there is a stylistic consistency of the first three that we've talked about, and I don't think this one fits.
No. Like,
so
that's what I loved about it.
Yeah. Yes. So one of these things is not like the other,
yes,
and I would argue this one is that thing. And the question that I had is why?
Why?
Yes. So it's much more spare visually,
mm-hmm,
than the other three. It was so sparse, and there was like that white background, like,
yes,
that overriding white background. And yes, we saw like the reeds and the brush and such, and the, you know, walking through the columns with walking through the columns with the plants on either side, but it just wasn't nearly as detailed visually as the other ones. And the other thing is, this is the only one that was not shot by Robert Yeoman. It was actually shot by Roman Coppola.
Yes.
So it still felt like a Wes Anderson visual extravaganza, if
yes,
you will, but
yeah,
it also felt really different. And even if Anderson has that consistency of style and his vision, you have to think that it does change with the different cinematographer. So there was that aspect to it.
Great point.
And the other aspect to this one is I just really, really liked Peter Swanson.
Me too.
I cared about the character, and I liked Henry Sugar, and I liked Dr. Chatterjee, and I definitely liked Imdad Khan, but I didn't really invest in them emotionally. I wasn't given the opportunity to invest in them emotionally.
That's
in
right.
The way I was this film. So this was actually my favorite.
Me too.
Quite liked it.
Yeah.
I thought it was just wonderful and magical. And the idea of it never says, but I think we're to assume that Rupert Friend is the grown-up Peter Swanson, right? I think that's pretty clear.
I think he does articulate that one time, and it's this weird little nugget. But there's...
I said.
Yes. Yeah, right? Yes, yeah. Exactly. He in the best surprise, I feel like it's even more emotional in that way too, right? To have the adult and the child existing in the same plane as the storytelling and doing the voice for his younger self, right? It's so interesting. I loved the visual difference. There was so much movement for how spare it was, obviously with the incredible effect of the eventual train. And the way that shot was one of the best choices, I feel like, it overall, and so magical and effective. This one, more than any of the others, really made me think about the choices and the devices of storytelling, and those reeds that you spoke of, and that hallway corridor feeling of walking towards us through those, both felt the most like documentary style, but also whimsical, and it more than any other felt like when I am trying to picture things in a book. There was something about the movement through those corridors that really spoke to brains, synapses, and like the way that you search for the visuals yourself. There was something really spectacular to me about him happening upon and making the choice of those devices. So I felt like it was most thoughtful in what it feels like to read, even though it was the least straight across as far as the literary translation, if that makes sense. Like, it was more visual and artful.
It's short, too. It's less than 20 minutes.
Yes.
And I thought when they tied into the railroad tracks and the train went over, that enough had already been done to make Peter Swanson a likable, sympathetic character in a way that Harry in Poison never was, Cumberbatch's character.
Like,
it just starts with a snake on his belly, whereas this established like that he was picked on, that he was small, that he was slight, that he was, but also like sensitive and caring and interested in the natural world, and to have his endeavor to look at birds be interrupted by the horrific Raymond and Ernie, just the worst kind of bullies, it made me root for him, and it made me want him to be okay. I did not want to say, I cared deeply that this kid is not hurt. And it was really kind of so deftly done, so quickly to establish that that alliance with the character. I really liked the way that it was done. It was beautiful. And then the ending, the idea of him taking those swan's wings and flying. Like, it was just wonderful. And there was almost like a Marquez element to it, right? Yes. Just that magic realism sort of sense. And if you think about Anderson's world, I wouldn't say that there's a magical element to them, like a magic realism element, but I would say there's a whimsy to them.
Totally.
And this kind of, this seems to be the next step of that whimsy, is to inject it with that element of magic. And it was so satisfying have him literally fly away. Fly away from his
gorgeous
captors.
And the quietness of that little tiny piece of what I think was stop motion, right? When we see the far shot of him in the tree with the wings, something is so calming about that, because you know, it's such an interesting visual gift in the middle of arguably another sort of obviously stressful situation, but sort of told in a different way, as you so beautifully described. But the tension is still building, and we don't know what's going to happen to him. But there's something about that far off view from the tree that's empowering and calming at the same time. I was fascinated by the effect of that. So I was thinking about the surprise of the stop motion alien in Asteroid City, and the quietness and interest and uncanniness of that moment, and what a sort of breath it is. But this had a shared but different effect on me, which was some sense that that he would overcome, that he was going to be okay. And I know that that is also, I think, somewhat articulated, that he was going to win, right? There's something about that. But there's something about the visual of that that helps us feel like he's going to win. But also, like, the adult-sized wings that we see on Rupert Friend, and with the little blood spots, and something is so incredible, just to speak to your analysis of the success of this way of storytelling. Something is so immediate and satisfying about the scale play in that. I also feel like Swanson is the most Wes Anderson character for these short stories. Like, that he is so good at those, like, incredibly lovable boys that we see throughout his career, and Swanson was absolutely one of those. You could have, I wanted to sort of cast him or insert him in past Anderson pieces, and something felt like the narrative flow was, in this case, more Anderson's than Dahl's. But the idea of it being based on a newspaper story, and that reveal at the end, was somehow really stunning too, because the empathy that it evokes compared to the other pieces, something about that being pulled from a stranger's story, felt like we could feel the empathy of the author.
So speaking of that, I got one more question.
Please.
To ask you. So this ends with what I found a surprising cutback to Ralph Fiennes as Roald Dahl.
Yes.
And he ends the story. And this is the fourth that was released. So it's like the end of the cycle, and it brings it full circle. That said, those little postscripts that we see for all these short films, they were written in wildly different time periods. It doesn't sound like he sat down and wanted to write a unified short story collection. This is not a Hemingway up in Michigan situation.
No.
It's not Alice Munro. Like, it's not a collection that was kind of uniformly written over a period of time with the intent of being a collection. It seems like they're kind of disparate pieces collected over time, put in this book. So my question to you that I've been thinking about is, are these tied together in any way other than by the Andersonian style? Is it Anderson that ties these together, or are somehow these narratives connected?
Right. Great question. I thought about that a lot, actually, because I was trying to find those through lines. Well, The Rat Catcher being, I feel like, what we described as the least connected. I feel like you could be generous and draw certain themes between them, but they seem wildly different in a lot of ways to me. And also, to speak to your point, very different time periods, very different mindsets. I feel like the fact that he kept that newspaper story about Swanson for 30 years is interesting to me, because that made it powerful to think about too, that this stayed with him somehow. Whereas I could see the Poison piece being maybe a more immediate translation of trauma or military memory, but it all felt very, very different from each other, quite honestly, even as far as metaphor, as far as what we might glean as lessons. It all felt like The Rat Catcher seemed odd, quaint, unfinished, and felt like, I guess what I don't remember if this is true, but maybe a later in life thought experiment, whereas there was something raw about some of it versus others. What's your theory? What do you think as far as connectivity?
I don't think there is much connectivity.
Yeah.
I think there was an attempt at connectivity with the device of Fiennes' Roald Dahl to insert that character at certain places, and it reminds us that, oh, this is the author and that's what's happening. But when I think the closest thing, I mean, there's nothing like it, right? There's the short film that he made that played before the Darjeeling Limited, but other than that, I don't know that he's really done much short filmmaking. Obviously, Bottle Rocket was a short film,
true,
which became a feature, but The closest thing to it's the French Dispatch. And just because these are these clear, discrete stories.
Yes.
That said, there's still a unifying structure in the French Dispatch, right? The magazine.
That's right.
In which these essays appeared, whereas these seem very disparate to me. And I do think they're united by style, because how could they not be? But I don't think they're united substantively by narrative concerns, which makes for viewing them, I viewed them singularly, but I also, last night I watched all four, and it's jarring. They don't feel of a piece in a way that I thought that they might. It's, there's something very different in his career.
Yes, I agree. No, it's mysterious in a way, but you're right. Stylistically, we have the Anderson through line, but I was really trying to, I was trying to figure out if there was a political through line and, or even like spiritual or anything. And it's, I was curious why these, maybe you can speak to this, why these particular pieces among what I assume would be quite a plethora of options, why these were the choices as far as Anderson was concerned, like what it was that spoke to him, because,
I don't know the answer to that. Okay. I do know he's been trying to answer, I do know that he's been trying to adapt these forever.
Okay.
And part of it might have been for him an exercise in success, in the sense that he couldn't crack these stories and struggled with it until he decided to present them like the stories in the book, with the he said, they did, that sort of, with the characters speaking as though they're reading their parts in the book. So maybe it was just that. But you would think that he could have gone to Netflix with anything
for
either of his own creation or Dahl. It seems these could have been released in festivals. I can't imagine that with the actors that are in them and the cachet that Anderson has, I imagine that he could have had these play at any high-end film festival in the world that he wanted to, which would have meant less viewership, more. Although, one thing's like, why didn't these play at the New York Film Festival or something like that? Which preceded by not too long, but preceded by a couple of weeks, their release on Netflix. Okay. It seems that there was it's all very strange.
It seems all a strange choice.
Yeah. It's a weird release. It's a weird venue. We don't think like these would be way better on Criterion.
Yes,
right.
It would.
It would be on Netflix, and you would think that you would hit. There's an audience that is there and wanting to see your work. For the Criterion subscriber is very selective, self-selected.
Yes, a specific viewer,
Netflix subscribers, which, I count myself, that's trash TV for me.
Fair enough, us too.
You turn it on and you just look for shit to watch,
Exactly, which it does feel like a disservice, because I feel like it would be, sadly, easier to ignore these pieces, which I do think are worthy art pieces that do deserve to be discussed and attended to, and I do find that a very odd choice, but maybe an interesting one in the possibility of accidental viewing. But I do think that platform, it's an odd one. I will say, just to speak to the sort of disparate seeming choices of these four, I do suppose it's more like a journal or a sort of almost like looking through someone's archives, and just if it was a sort of random research project of these short stories from very different mindsets, times, places, that's interesting actually. Also, if we don't think of it as needing to be connected, I do feel like it speaks to the source material in that sense, that these are all based on very different things and they are short stories, not even a dedicated collection of specific short stories, right? But just choices and archives, something sort of makes me think more about the author and the source material in that sense. And maybe that was the intention, just to try and like riff on that a little bit more. Just, I do wonder, I'd love to hear, that process, right, of the narrowing down.
Well, that's a great place to end this, Kenda. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Super fun to talk about these. Seriously. I can't believe, so we've actually made 90 cold opens,
what?
If you include the minis, but this is, as concerns the maxis.
Yes.
This has been the cold open number 50, The Wonderful World of Henry Sugar Edition.